Hello again. You're listening to the News at One. Well, from an ambitious, if highly controversial, plan to transform top-flight European soccer to disarray, recriminations and abject apologies, and all in less than 48 hours. This week's ill-fated deal for a European soccer super league is in ruins today after 8 of the 12 teams involved withdrew. Political and fan opposition, particularly in England, brought the plan crashing down before a single match had been played. The chairman of Juventus has admitted this morning that the league is no longer viable after a revolt by players, managers and fans forced a dramatic U-turn. This morning, the principal owner of Liverpool Football Club, John Henry, apologised to players, management and fans at the club.
I hope you'll understand that even when we make mistakes, we're trying to work in your club's best interests. In this endeavour, I've let you down. Again, I'm sorry. And I alone am responsible for the unnecessary negativity brought forward over the past couple of days. It's something I won't forget and shows the power that fans have today and will rightly continue to have.
John Henry of Liverpool FC. Well, let's talk to Dr. Robert Butler now from the Centre for Sport Economics at University College Cork. Robert, a very good afternoon to you and thank you for taking our call. So much of this story, which evolved so dramatically over the last number of days, is just summed up there in what John Henry was saying and his tone, this abject apology. The owners of these clubs, it seems, just completely misjudging what was possible in relation to their intentions.
Good afternoon, Brian. Yeah, I think you've summed it up well there. I think they completely fail to understand the intangible aspects of these clubs, that these clubs, particularly the English clubs, are more than just money or more than just businesses. And there's a whole fabric of institutions that are intertwined into these clubs that are in many cases over 100 years old. And there's been a complete failure to recognise that. And I think in particular, there's probably two aspects. One is the aspect of identity. And identity in European sport and in English football are very, very important. And you don't see that same emotional attachment in the US. So in the US, for example, franchises will regularly move from different locations and be placed in different cities. And that's not seen as something necessarily negative, whereas that doesn't happen in European football. And I think the American owners in particular fail to recognise that. And I think the second big issue is on promotion and relegation. That is a cornerstone of European football, and it's been there for over 100 years. And removing promotion and relegation simply changes the entire dynamic of football.
We're also joined on the line by sports journalist Tariq Panja from the New York Times. Tariq, it was you and your colleagues who broke this story earlier this week. We know that there were teams involved in this potential league from Spain, from Italy and England, but actually it was the fury of the English fans that brought it down, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was the kind of soft underbelly and the power of the competition, the six English clubs. And I think they were targeted by those opposing it. There was efforts from UEFA, European Soccer's governing body, to really get in touch with officials in the UK government. And they're also pretty sure that the fans in Britain are more vocal than those elsewhere when it comes to governance matters. And that's what they did. They pursued a strategy of trying to pick off teams perhaps one at a time in order to undermine the breakaway.
And politically as well, it was a story that got significant traction. Boris Johnson, other members of the Conservative government, I suppose, seen an opportunity here, and they were very quick out of the traps to condemn this plan.
Absolutely. This was a golden opportunity. It's like pushing at an open door. You know, Boris Johnson saves football. You couldn't think of a better headline than that. For a government, if you think about it, had been in a bit of trouble the week before with sleaze allegations mounting against it. So, you know, being the saviour of the people's game is a position that Boris Johnson, I'm sure, relished.
But I suppose, on the other hand, Robert, the pressures that led to this plan being devised are still there. The enormous financial pressures that so many of these clubs, particularly the ones not owned by the, you know, by the Abramovich's or by the Middle East oil states, those financial pressures aren't going away.
The financial pressures are still there, and I think in the terms of the teams that were part of this Super League, particularly the Spanish teams, it was probably more important that this was established, because qualification to the Champions League is almost guaranteed. In the case of the English teams, it was more about trying to guarantee their income rather than serious financial pressure. So the motivations were slightly different depending on where the clubs were coming. And I think almost everybody would be in agreement that there does need to be a restructuring of the current European football arrangement and how that happens, particularly with club competitions and international competitions. But the European Super League was not the answer to that. And I think it was a serious miscalculation of judgment by the 12 clubs to think it was.
So where do you think they'll turn now, these top clubs, badly bruised by this, when they presumably dust themselves down and start to try and plan for the future? What might they be looking at?
So I think UEFA's reaction is now very important. So it seems that UEFA are welcoming them back into the fold, because I think there's a codependence here. As much as UEFA don't like this, they do need these teams. And then these clubs obviously need their domestic leagues and UEFA as well. So I don't think there's any winners if there are recriminations from this. I certainly think it will leave a scar, and I certainly think UEFA will listen, but it won't go anywhere near the guarantees that the 12 clubs want, and particularly the guaranteed income from a system that's closed, that doesn't have relegation. And I think that can't be the case, because the minute you move towards a guarantee, you remove one of the cornerstones of sport, the idea that nothing is guaranteed. You are guaranteed an opportunity, but you're certainly not guaranteed an outcome.
I suppose, Tariq, also a factor in this is that different clubs have come from, if you like, a different point financially in relation to this. There are those whose owners aren't particularly looking for the clubs to make money. Others, like the Glaziers, it's very much a financial investment.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the, if we look at the Premier League, it's got an ownership neutral stance, is how it's described, which means anyone within reason, as long as they don't have a criminal record, can essentially buy an English club, whoever they are, wherever they come from. And like you said, the motivations are very different. We've got American owners who have entered UK sport, particularly football, looking to what they see as undervalued assets, looking to increase the valuation of them, and see them as a method towards making money. Then you have, you know, something like Abu Dhabi that owns Manchester City, and it is nothing to do with profits. This is one of the richest, part of one of the richest states in the world. This is a soft power play, a branding exercise, and they're willing to pump as much money as possible. And to be honest with you, that speaks to the sort of fundamental issues in football. This kind of unfettered capitalism, the money that's poured in, it's created have-nots and haves, but not because of anything that's happened on the field, but through who owns the teams. For example, Barcelona and Real Madrid, the teams that, you know, really pushing this among the others, they don't have the opportunity to have cash infusions. They're member-owned. They can't be owned by an entity. They can't be owned by a billionaire, and they can't be owned by a sheikh. So they have to field teams and raise their talent on money that they earn themselves, and they were fearing for their futures.
I mean, another factor perhaps, Robert, is that for teams in Italy and Spain, there aren't the opportunities for, across a range of clubs, really top-class competition in the sense that it exists in the Premiership.
Yeah, so competitive balance is an issue. I suppose the Premier League is fortunate in that regard, and particularly in more recent times, and I know Manchester City are running away with the league this season, but in terms of competition for the Champions League places, it is very competitive. There's 6, 7, 8 teams that can potentially qualify this season for the Champions League. Spain is different because Barcelona and Real Madrid have dominated it. Italy has been dominated by Juventus for a decade. It won't be the case this season, but again, yeah, balance is an issue. And one of the motivations behind the Super League was to try and bring what these clubs perceive to be more balanced games, and the big bonus for them was eye-watering sums of money. But I think fan power has won out here, and I'm surprised surprised that the owners didn't see this coming and coming so quickly, because there are examples of fan power, even with like less obvious or much smaller issues, like Cardiff City trying to change a jersey and from red to blue, like Hull City trying to change their name to Hull Tigers. And these things have been opposed vehemently by the fans, because the fans in England are very vocal and they're opposed to changes like this.
Tariq, finally to you, fan power won out here, but is there also a sense in which the genie is out of the bottle and won't be put back?
I think you can go back 30 years. You don't need to wait for today to see the genie is out of the bottle. This is a process that has kind of reached its logical conclusion with what's happened over the last 48 hours. What I find astounding is suddenly governments around the world, around Europe, you know, hand-wringing, etc., talking about rapacious owners and saying something must be done. But you have to ask yourselves if this sport was so important, such a important cultural phenomenon for millions of people, where were the safeguards before? We've had successive governments kind of ignore football until it gets to this crisis point. Maybe had they put safeguards in earlier, we wouldn't have reached where we are today.
Very good. We'll leave it there. Tariq Panja from the New York Times and Robert Butler from UCC. Thank you both for talking to us this lunchtime.